Hello.
Hey.
How's it going?
It's going well.
Hi, this is Soraya.
And this is Jeff.
Our podcast is called Paisley Stage Raspberry and Rhyme.
A podcast where the two of us play music that we like and share anecdotes and background about the tunes.
We hope you'll join our conversation. And without further ado, a groovear.
Let's get groovy. Okay, Soraya, so today's show, we're going to be talking about Dream Syndicate's Medicine Show. We've already talked we've talked about the 3 o'clock Arrive Without Traveling. We've talked about the Bangles All Over the Place. Then we talked to the guys on Rain Parade about Crashing Dream. So our next album focus is Medicine Show, an album that I absolutely love.
Yes.
And we were like, go ahead.
I just want to add one thing. And for our listeners, if you haven't given this album a listen in a while, it's worth it. And for those of you who are new and haven't listened to it, you need to hear this album in its entirety. It's fantastic.
It is. And it was quite a change, like coming off of Days and Wine and Roses. So
right.
I had that album. Then when this album came out, it was new. It was on A&M, so it was on a major label. I didn't know what to expect. And actually, the first couple times that I listened to it, I was in shock. Like, what happened? What happened to this noisy, loud, feedbacky band that was on Days of Wine and Roses to this more polished sound? And it took me a couple times. It was actually a grower for me, where at first I was a little in shock, and after a few listens, it really sunk its teeth into me.
Yeah, I think I think that experience is similar to mine. You know, because. I think your expectations are set in one direction after listening to Days of Wine and Roses, and then boom, you know.
Yeah.
But Sandy Perlman comes into the mix, and you know, we get a new album. You know, we get a new sound, and it's pretty cool.
Yeah. So we just got done talking with the rhythm section, both Dennis Duck and Dave Provost. What did you think about those calls?
First of all, both of them are a real joy to talk to and have got stories galore. And, but it really did help me see these tracks in a completely different light. And, I mean, you're going to hear it too, but for me, the revelation was Dennis talking about Side B, and it's like, oh, okay. Now it's more cohesive for me, at least. You know, in terms of listening to it and I thought it was, I like talking to both of them.
Yes.
And Dave Provost has got, he's got stories.
Yeah. Well, let's start with Dennis's interview. We'll play that now.
Fantastic.
Hello.
Hi, Dennis.
Hey. Hi, kid.
Hi.
I like being called a kid. Nice. Today we're speaking with longtime Dream Syndicate drummer Dennis Duck about their 1984 A&M Records release, Medicine Show. Dennis and Steve Wynn are the two members of the band that have remained in the lineup consistently throughout the entirety of Dream Syndicate's career. And Dennis, welcome to Paisley Stage Raspberry and Rhyme.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So glad that you joined us. So Dennis, before we touch on Medicine Show, we wanted to speak with you briefly about the new Dream Syndicate material. So the band recently released a new single, Black Light, from your upcoming album, These
right.
Times. Yep, that's due out May 3rd on Anti Records. Then the song shows, in my mind, the band taking a slightly new direction. So what can you tell us and our listeners about what we can expect on These Times?
Okay. Yeah, I think it's more than slightly, I hope. You know, since this kind of second version of the band got together, we started in 2012. And, of course, at first we just enjoyed playing shows and we didn't necessarily know we were going to make another album. But as we were playing, we realized we loved playing together. Fans were digging it, and people started asking, are you guys going to make a record? And So we did, and we did have I Found Myself Here, and that seemed to be very, very well received. And so we said, what the heck, let's do another one. And I think really, I hope I'm not speaking out of turn for everybody else, but I think the prevailing attitude with all of us is, okay, we have a legacy as a band. We really have nothing to prove. Let's push forward. You know, let's not try to remake stuff we've done, you know, tread the same ground that we've been on before. And so I think particularly, I mean, you saw it a little bit in the last record, I think. It had maybe some older style songs, but then some newer ones as well. And I think this one we really wanted to push forward and do something new. I hope that's what we did. I hope you can hear it in the single Black Light. I think that's one of my favorite tracks on the album. And I just think it really, I can't stop listening to it. I just love the way it sounds. I like the mood of it. It's weird and somewhat psychedelic, and you know, I don't know. Well, anyway.
Rough and steely strong, a weathered eye with a ticking heart. I know where and why, but not how long. Exposed against the night, colors flip and reunite. Under the black light, sucker punch the misery truck. Sweet jitteries, random luck. Trick the body, but the mind won't follow. The mission is mighty, but the foundation is hollow. Revealed by the night, switching the polarity of science against the black light. Below the surface, waiting for semaphore light in the dark. And they play for me with synergy, lethargy, fantasies, broken needles and dead batteries. Suspended by the night, it's funny the things you see. When you flip on the black light, exposed against the night, colors flip and lure of the black light.
Really nothing else on the album that sounds exactly like that. I think Steve kind of wrote a little bio about the album, and he kind of describes it as being kind of like a late night DJ experience where, you know, each song is a little bit of a different journey. And so I think you'll find out that's true, and I hope that's something that you like. But yeah, I mean, the approach for this record was a little bit different. You know, we started with kind of little bits of song ideas and went into the studio and kind of put things together on the fly. And just the idea being to really rely on the band to create the songs rather than having strictly written songs, you know. It was a bit risky, but I hope it paid off. I think it did. So that's the new record. You know, once you hear it, and we can talk about that if you want.
Perfect.
See what you think.
I'm gonna hold you to that.
Oh, see, now I've done it. Oh my goodness.
Well, you know, we're looking forward to it, and May 3rd, for all our listeners, you need to have this album in your collection. And Black Light is a fantastic single. And just like Jeff said, we're really digging it and listening to it multiple times. So we're enjoying it as much as you. But Dennis,
I really appreciate that.
Absolutely. We want to get into the album that REM's Peter Buck calls, and I quote, "The Exile on Main Street for the 80s, end quote. And that's Medicine Show.
Wow, I know if I've heard that quote before. Thanks, Peter.
So the lineup for Medicine Show is a little different than that of the previous release, Days of Wine and Roses. Kendra Smith, at this point, has left the band, been replaced by Dave Provost. Can you talk to us a little bit about how it was different playing with Dave versus playing with Kendra for this album, for Medicine Show?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, gosh, I love Kendra more than anything, and I don't think I'm exaggerating to say that I was devastated when she called me one day and told me that she was leaving the band. Not because of anything against the band, but she didn't really like touring. She's a little more of a homebody than the rest of us, and she had some other things she wanted to do. It was a very amicable, you know, parting of ways, and she and I have stayed friends throughout that, and over the years, and of course she and Steve have as well. But playing with Dave, so you know, Kendra was self-taught. Dave is a maestro on the bass, so just a whole different approach. You know, Dave can play virtually any song that you can imagine just on the bass, and you'll know it's on you. I mean, he's really an amazing bass player. So it was, I think it pushed us a little bit into a more disciplined sound. I remember playing on stage, touring, you know, obviously touring with REM, and the songs got a little tighter, got a little more structured, a little less frenzied maybe. And I think Dave had something to do with that. He's a very professional, just a bass player. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean, it's a very good thing. So I think that's the difference, just a very different style.
It sounds like you guys really locked in on Medicine Show. The rhythm section is really tight. But Dennis, we wanted to ask you, for the recording of Medicine Show, the band was in a couple different studios in San Francisco, Time Enough and World Enough Studios and Automat. And you guys had Sandy Pearlman as the producer. And Sandy had previously worked with Blue Oyster Cult and, of course, the classic Give 'Em Enough Rope by The Clash. How was it for you working with Sandy?
So, yeah, I think I was thinking about that today and trying to kind of remember my impressions about it. I think we were all, you know, of course we knew Sandy from those albums you mentioned. And it was sort of our first experience working with a quote unquote big time producer, you know, and I think we were all a little starstruck. Just, wow, this is Sandy Pearlman, and he's producing us. Oh boy. Now, he, of course, you know, The Days Wine and Roses was basically made in 24 hours. You know, we tracked all the basic tracks in 8 hours. Everything was one take, except I think Days Wine and Roses, maybe we went crazy and did two takes.
Wow.
So, wow, what a difference working with Sandy. You know, Sandy wanted to work meticulously on every song. And so, you know, we did maybe would work a full day on one song. So, boy, that was really a different experience. But, you know, he was great. He's super knowledgeable, super professional. And I think he had a vision of what he thought the record should be. And I think it was a little bit different than what Steve thought, and then maybe even a little different from what Carl thought. So you sort of had three different visions of this record kind of going at the same time. It was a great experience for the most part. And that's what I remember.
And what about we wanted to know about the track listing. Did you have any part in the sequencing of Medicine Show?
No, I didn't personally. I'm not sure if Steve and Carl did. They may have. I have a feeling Sandy probably pretty much put that together. That's my guess, but I don't know for sure. But I love the way it flows. I think it's perfect. I wouldn't change a thing about the sequencing.
Yeah. I'd have to agree with you, yeah.
Yeah, I agree too.
You know, my musical background, when I first started really getting into music and into albums, you know, it was the era of FM radio. It was the era of, you know, when albums really came into their own, you know, starting with, I guess, Sgt. Pepper and things beyond that. And I always loved, like, of course, I was a Pink Floyd fan, so I loved those albums where, like, one side of the album was one song. You know, that was
right.
Wonderful. And so I liked that about Medicine Show, that side two is sort of the three longer songs. You know, it's a different than side one. And that kind of pulls me back to those early days of album, what I liked about albums in the first place. I just want to throw that in.
Yeah, no, definitely. So that kind of leads me into what I was going to ask next. And my favorite song from the album is Merrittville. Soraya likes armed with an empty gun. All with an empty gun, and no one to call my bluff. The guardsmen at the border were afraid to play rough. I was armed with an empty gun. I was armed with an empty gun. Yeah. Although we like all the songs, but those are our favorites at this moment. Can you tell us what your favorite song is from the album?
Oh, my goodness. That's hard because I like something about all of them. Mm-hmm. Medicine Show. No, you said You said Marisville.
For mine, yeah.
Yeah, that's the one. That, yeah, you know, I remember talking to Steve about the album when he was working on the songs and we got into recording. And he was really into making it something like writing prose, like writing short stories or writing a novel. You know, I think he had that idea. Like they were very, I think Days of Wine and Roses was sort of more about the inner psychology of different sort of twisted characters. And this is too to a point, but I think Medicine Joe is more about little stories, little vignettes about experiences. And I think Marisville, to me, exemplifies that the best, maybe, of any song on the album, although other songs do as well. Marisville is, you just close your eyes, you're on a journey, maybe, right, to the American South. You know, I think that was his intent, and I think it really comes through. You know, I love playing that song live. I see the reaction of Pete Sands when we play it, and people really love it because it's a slower song. It's not super intense like a lot of the other songs, and it's kind of has a stately tone to it. So I think it really sets itself apart from a lot of the other songs, not only on that album, but songs that the band in general goes. And then you said, did you say Medicine Show?
Armed with an Empty Gun with Sarayas.
Oh, Armed with an Empty Gun, yes. Yeah, that's another fun song. And that's the song that really was transformed in the recording process. It was played so differently when we first started playing it live. And then once we got in the studio and recorded it, it definitely got an interesting treatment. And now I love it so much, I can barely remember how we used to play it before the album. But that's a fun song. And again, that's, you know, that's really unique. There's really nothing else like that song that this band has done, I don't think. Gosh, I couldn't pick a favorite. I still throw that record on sometimes and listen to it all the way through, and I just feel happy that it exists, and I feel very lucky just to have been part of it. And really, it's a wonderful piece of music all the way through.
You know, we can, your joy in talking about, you know, playing the songs on this album, it's really palpable for Jeff and I to hear it. And we just love to hear anything, you know, what other personal feelings do you have about this album? We hear, you know, like, oh, I can't pick a favorite because there's something I appreciate about each song. But, you know, it's been 35 years since Medicine Show was released. And, you know, just looking back, reflecting back on it, are there any other personal feelings or just reflections about this album, you know, because it is something that Jeff and I, we agree, this is such a poignant album.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so we just would love to hear a little more about your feelings about it.
Okay, let's see. Well, I mean, I don't know, not sure about feelings. Just to talk about the track John Coltrane Stereo Blues, I mean, you guys probably, your fans, so you probably know this, but that song goes way, way, way back to even before we ever recorded any album or anything. We played that song live at KPFK Studios at 2 a.m. in the morning. It was not called John Coltrane Stereo Blues. It wasn't called anything. It was basically an improvisation based on a riff that Steve had. And at the time, we called it Open Hour.
Wow.
For a very strange reason. Yeah. So if you put your hands on that KPFK, those KPFK tracks, you'll hear very early bits of John Coltrane Stereo Blues in its earliest form. Anyway, what I was going to say is I really like the fact that we carried that through to this album. Developed it quite a bit. I mean, it actually turned into a song, turned into something with real direction and purpose. But you know, it made me happy. I remember at the time thinking, wow, you know, we're bringing this song all the way from one of our very first shows, and putting it on this record. So I was glad that there was that kind of continuity, I guess is what I'm trying to get at.
That's really cool.
Other feelings, I think it's just, I just remember adapting to the experience of working with Sandy. I think that's the main thing that I remember, because his style was so different than Chris D, who produced the first record.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Sandy was very meticulous, and it took a little bit of adjustment on my part, you know, maybe for all of us. But, you know, once we settled into it, we we got used to it, and, you know, we trusted that he knew what he was doing, and he did. Let's see. Yeah, working, it was great being in San Francisco. You know, I loved the city at the time, and I loved, you know, being able to stay there and work in the studio all day and walk around the city. And it just, that was especially nice. I can't think of a better city to be in to work on your record than San Francisco at that time. Let's see.
So Dennis,
trying to think of any other impressions I might have had.
Okay.
Sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say that we had read that Steve had said that the album took over 5 months to record, and that's with you guys working 7 days a week, 14 hours a day. And that's including overdubs and mixing. So it's quite a bit of time spent on this album.
Right. Yeah, exactly. As opposed to, you know, 24 hours to do Days of Lemon Roses.
So yeah, quite
barely one day, and a single take for every song almost. So I was there for the first 2 weeks doing drum tracks. I think Dave maybe also was there for 2 weeks doing bass. I'm not sure if he stayed on after that. And then I went home. And Steve and Carl and Sandy. And Tommy kind of finished it, worked on it for the next 5 months. And, you know, I was home just waiting for any little tidbit of information I could have about how it was going. I was anxious to hear the record that we were making, that they were making. It was amazing that it went for 5 months.
Oh, wow.
That, you know, that's an experience that none of us had ever had.
And probably not since.
No, not since either. I mean, yeah, but like now, these last two records, I think we were in the studio for 10 days, barely. Yeah, you know, so yeah, I mean, I don't think we right now we need to work that way or want to work that way, but definitely that, I think I'm glad we did with Innocent Show, because the results were great.
Absolutely. I did want to ask you a question particularly about recording the drums. Did Sandy have any particular style in the way that he went about recording your kit?
Not really a style, but you know, you have to remember this was 1984, and this was before you didn't have digital recording technology back then. It was still all tape.
Mm-hmm.
So Sandy... One thing Sandy would do is, you know, we'd record take after take after take of drums, and then Sandy would go sit down, you know, in the control room with splicing kit and splice, you know, tapes together. Oh, I like this bit of the drums. I like this chorus. I like this verse. You know, and just kind of put together his, the, you know, greatest hits of my drum playing.
Wow.
And that's fine. I mean, that's how a lot of people did that at the time. I don't mind that. I mean, I'm more of a purist. I mean, I'd prefer to just play through, you know, but all the way through. But that was his style. So that was his approach to the drums. And I know he did that a lot on the album. But, you know, listening to it now, I couldn't tell you where, because it sounds so seamless.
Wow. So, Dennis, do you have any particular memories or stories about the lead-off track still holding on to you?
Yeah, it's been written in stone. You're gone, and you're not coming home. But I know that it's true, and it's real.
The only memory I have of that track is that it changed in the studio from the way we played it previously. If you listen to live tapes of us playing that song, Pre-Medicine Show, that Carl changed the way he plays that opening riff a little bit. And I can't, now it's funny, I can't quite remember how I used to play it, but it was just a different style of playing that one particular riff. And I think he and Sandy decided that they wanted to change and play a little different. So when I finally heard the record, when it was done, I mean, I really didn't hear much of anything until it was completely finished. I was very surprised that that was the riff for that song. I hadn't heard it played like that before. That took a little getting used to, but now I'm used to it now. And like I said, I barely remember how I played it before that. But I love that. I love that song. I just think, you know, Steve there's a particular type of song that Steve can write. And Tell Me When It's Over, I think, is that kind of song.
Mm-hmm.
Still Holding On to You is that kind of song. You know, maybe Sight'll Never Show is that kind of song. I think Filter Me Through You on the last record is that kind of song. I don't know how to describe that kind of song, but if you see the thread between those, there's a certain style of thing that he's writing there. He's very good at writing that.
I had one more question, and that was, so this was the last album that Carl worked on. Could you tell at the time of the recording that this was probably going to be his last time working with the band in the studio?
No, I don't think I don't think I could. I didn't really see that coming. You know, I didn't really, like I said, I was back home in L.A. when those guys were working on it for the next 5 months. So I didn't really hear much in the way of stories about, you know, how it went recording. And, you know, there definitely was some tension between Steve and Carl during that time. I don't know the particulars, but I know that there was. And I think that obviously that led to Carl. But no, I didn't. I have to say, I think Carl really enjoyed recording that record. He and Sandy got along great. You know, Carl had a different vision of that record, I think, in a sense that he wanted to make more of a big rock record rather than like an indie kind of rock record. And Sandy kind of had that vision too. So I think that Carl was very happy to be in the studio with someone that shared his direction a little bit. So now he seemed very happy in the studio. I mean, I seemed like he and Steve were getting along fine when I was there. So I didn't see anything. I didn't see anything coming, to be honest. But you never know.
Right. Well, it sounds like a very cohesive record that you guys were all hitting on all cylinders. And Soraya and I, this is a masterpiece.
Oh, thank you. I'm really happy to hear you say that. It means a lot. Thank you.
Soraya. And, go ahead, Soraya.
Yeah, I just want to thank you, Dennis, for joining us to talk about this album that Jeff and I absolutely love. I mean, I think we've said it so many times, but we really just enjoy this album. And talking about it with you has been a nice eye opener, and we look forward to this new release, and you're always welcome here. We'd love to talk with you about the new album once it's released. And yeah, we can't wait to have you back on. I am going to hold you to that.
I'm stuck now, aren't I?
But thank you so much for your time. We really do appreciate it.
Yes. Thank you, Dennis.
It was a real pleasure. Thank you.
Enjoy the rest of your day.
Cheers. Yeah, thanks.
Thanks. Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right. And now that you've heard Dennis Stack, we'd like to share with you our conversation with Dave Provost.
Today, we're speaking with Dave Provost, who has quite a busy career to date, playing with numerous artists, including Sky Saxon, Textones, Dwight Twilley, Droogs, Wednesday Week, Russ Tolman, tons of people. But today, we've invited Dave onto the show to talk about an album that Soraya and I both love, and that's Dream Syndicate's Medicine Show. So, Dave, we wanted to welcome you to Paisley Stage Raspberry and Rhyme.
Well, thanks for the welcome.
Dave, we wanted to pick your brain a little bit about this album in particular and ask you to kind of reach back to your memories of 1983, 1984, when you joined the band to record Medicine Show. Kendra Smith had recently left the Dream Syndicate, and we'd like to know a little bit about how you came to join the band at that time.
Okay, I had known Steve for a while, and I actually knew Kendra too, and just, you know, from around clubs. And I had gotten together with Steve and done some living room recording with him probably 2 years before he had Dream Syndicate going. And I was really, really impressed with the stuff that he was writing. And I at that point I was playing with, you know, the Dwight Twively people, and I was still like, this guy's really got it. And so when Kendra left, Steve, for some reason, had a couple of possibilities in mind. And he called me, and we got together with the band. I played one time. It was not even a rehearsal. It was just a jam in Dennis Duck's garage, and it clicked. It sounded good. Now, they were halfway through promoting the Days of Wine and Roses. They had done one leg of the tour when Kendra left.
Oh, okay.
So we did a few dates around Los Angeles, and they were fun. And we were planning on going out on tour with Jonathan Richman.
Ooh.
And the manager, Dream Syndicate's manager, said, "Well, you're not doing that tour. You guys are going out with U2. And U2 was kind of an up and coming band still. They had, I mean, you know, they were well known, but they hadn't really cracked the mainstream yet. So we were a little bit disappointed about not going out with Jonathan Richman at that time.
Wow.
And so what happened is we wound up going out with that. And then, you know, I think we did 13 or 14 dates with U2, East Coast, and then a couple dates in Canada and Portland and Seattle. And it was really a blast. Then we continued with another full tour of the United States, promoting Days of Wine and Roses and sprinkling in new songs. I think we were opening with Burn just about every night.
The cop says why he done it, as they fastened up the cuffs. He looked at what he done and said, "Guess I just don't know. No, I don't know." But you can't feel in your heart, feel in your soul, feel it go.
We were starting to kind of realize the songs that would wind up on Medicine Show. So we did get a chance to actually play those a lot. And in typical fashion of Dream Syndicate at that point, they were never the same way twice. You know, because there was really no format. It was almost like, you know, we had a basic idea of the structure in our mind, but other than that, we didn't even use set lists. Steve would just call the songs as he felt that they were going to happen.
Wow.
And so I would say it was closer to being in Ornette Coleman's band than being in a rock band, you know. It was, you know, and so, you know, you see the band now, it's a well-greased machine. Back then it was a little bit more precarious, as far as, you know, it was dangerous. Things could fall apart at any second, but they didn't, you know. So so it was fun. And so I did about 86 shows with them. And we when we were in talks with Geffen, with David Geffen, who I liked a lot, and we were pretty certain that we were going to go with Geffen, and then there was a little last-minute change, and we found out we were going with A&M, and that Sandy Perlman was coming on board as the producer. And Sandy had mixed our show, opening for U2, at the Capitol Theater in Passaic, New Jersey. And so he kind of had a real idea of what we were capable of doing. And I think he was of a similar mindset. And I think he was a good person. And so that was our connection with Sandy.
Oh, wow. So. Wow, that's great. Man, what a introduction to the band, opening for U2 right off the bat. Hey, can you tell
some of the shows that were the most exciting were in smaller venues. You know, it was pretty unpredictable. Like every rock band goes through, you have nights where you don't expect things to be spectacular, but in small rooms like Folk City, or you know, I had a few personal favorite gigs that were in places like Syracuse, just that you would not, you know, that weren't in like major showbiz hubs. And so it was definitely fun.
Wow.
So it's great. So we've worked our way to the actual recording now. So
that's crazy. So can you tell us a little bit about the songwriting process for Medicine Show? It sounds like most of it was being put together on the road. We did notice that you were credited as a co-writer on John Coltrane's Stereo Blues. So how was the songwriting process?
Well, you know, I think Steve and Carl both had their own idea on how to write songs, and I think that they were coming from similar places. I would say the songwriting process was all within Steve. You know, other than the, you know, the songs that Carl had, you know, Bullet With My Name On It. Halloween, that were both, you know, Carl's songs. I think Some Kind of Itch was a, you know, was a Carl song, you know, from earlier. But for the most part, it was Steve jotting down things that he saw out of the window of the van as we traveled. And I think the characters on Medicine Show were all basically caused by things that he actually observed while we were touring. I think that, you know, that it was, and I think he, in his mind, was making up storylines to go with the people that he actually, you know, experience or see. And so as far as my observation about Steve's songs is that he actually becomes the character that, He's not doing an objective overview of these characters. He is the character that he's singing about. And it's kind of like method acting. I think that he actually basically embodies the character while he's singing it. And so I think that was part of his process, was that he had to actually feel the characters in his songs, or they weren't there.
Wow.
That's
crazy. So specifically with John Coltrane's Stereo Blues, can you tell us how that one came together, seeing as you're a co-writer for that?
Well, they had actually done that song with Kendra before I was playing with them. And I think my contribution was the bass line. And I think that the bass line becomes kind of like a signature riff.
Well, I might have
you know, at the Kendra's lines on things like "That's What You Always Say," you know, that that the, you know, the riff actually becomes part of the song. And so other than that, I wasn't, you know, I wasn't going up to Steve and whispering, you know, I got some fine wine in the freezer. Go with that, you know. that was all, you know.
Nice.
Yeah.
And just to kind of piggyback on this, Steve Wynn has mentioned in interviews that recording Medicine Show took over 5 months, including overdubs and mixing, working 7 days a week, 14 hours a day. Do you have any other recollections or memories that you care to share about the process of recording this album? That's pretty intense.
Oh, that's standard. All bands do that. Yeah, no, the, well, you know, we pull into, we had been doing a lot of shows in San Francisco, and I think, you know, the Dream Syndicate actually started, you know, as the Suspects in Northern California. And so I think that San Francisco was a good choice of cities to record in. They had put us up in these penthouse apartments, these condos overlooking all of San Francisco around the corner of Polk and Market Street. I think it was Fox Tower. And the then we go to the, we check into the automat, and it is a really warm, comfortable, large building with you know, the wood grain walls. It was just very very posh, and the finest equipment on the planet at that point. These were 48 track automated boards, which was pretty unheard of at that time. And the studios were pretty, I mean, they were very nice, very large. And at that point, we were four guys that were used to being crammed in a sardine can of a van, you know, and, you know, and we were used to, you know, playing CBGB and, you know, and venues that, you know, didn't have running water and barely had electricity. And here we are in this, you know, in this with, Steve and Carl had gotten new amplifiers, and Carl had gotten a new guitar, and it was, we realized that, even with all these nice trappings we were in, we were still, under, you know, with Sandy Pearlman, and Sandy, you know, was a larger than life kind of figure. And we, I think we quickly, found that his, process, he was not pressed for time. Even if labels were pressed for time, he wasn't. He was working on his own calendar, which was different than the than the typical Mayan calendar or whatever. But he so time meant nothing to Sandy. It was very it was a different process. And one thing, Sandy had come out of working, he had just done an album with The Clash not to you know, long before we went in with him, and he did not have a really good experience working with them. And I think he was determined to have control over what he did and the creative process. I think that his way of working with us, he really wanted to kind of get into the psyche of each individual member of the band and figured out what worked. He wasn't looking for perfection. That was one thing. Everything on the radio at that time was becoming computerized and homogenized, drum machines and sequence, you know, everything sequenced. And Sandy, as much as us, I think what he saw in us was a big bag of imperfections that was attractive to him. You know, I think he really wanted happy accidents. He wanted imperfections. He wanted, you know, things that were uniquely each individual's soul. And but he's doing this in the most modern of equipment for that time. And so I think there was a little bit of, you know, Sandy trying I don't think he really knew what it was going to sound like in his mind. A lot of producers go in with an idea of what the finished product is going to be. I think Sandy was like, you know, I'm just going to, you know, grab on, you know, and just hang on and see where this leads, you know. And but he knew it when he heard it. That was the thing. He didn't know what he wanted to hear, but when he heard it, he knew that was it. And I think that he got a lot out of Steve as far as actually bringing out the best in Steve as far as the vocals, as far as the rhythm section. I think he wanted us to be a machine, which I think Dennis and I were kind of a machine together, but I think he wanted us to be a machine with flaws. Yeah. So sometimes we would do what I would consider a perfect rock solid take that I think anybody in the world would have used as a rhythm track. And Sandy would look at it, because before digital recording, you couldn't just, you know, scoot the bass up to where it matches the bass drum. You know, you couldn't place things like that. It had to be happening. And sometimes I think he would go with a take that wasn't perfect. And then another day he'd wake up and he'd hear the sound of Dennis's floor tom and he'd go, you know, that's really beautiful, but it's not quite right. And one day he had somebody come in that spent the entire day just tuning Dennis's floor tom. This was like a whole day that we sat there while they tuned the floor tom. And this was for Armed with an Empty Gun. And it was beautiful. It was beautiful. And then when I heard playbacks of that, I think we all did this at one point or another, but I think I might have been the first to tell Sandy. I'm like, Sandy, you don't need bass on that. Just have the floor come in through it, because it was a droning note that just carried the whole bottom. And I'm like, you know, I'm not that egotistical where I have to hear those three notes that I played on the recording. You know, I could hear those elsewhere. It was just that was just so beautiful, you know, what Dennis, exactly where Dennis was hitting it on the drum was just perfect, you know. But so sometimes Sandy would get like that. The other thing is that Carl at this time was a separate process of recording. I think Carl was hearing things in his mind, you know, guitar ideas. And he was, he hadn't actually developed the muscle memory to actually go where other guitar players would go when they hear something and they can just play it. He would have to bend notes until they were there, you know. And I think that the process that Sandy used with Carl was, you know, just letting Carl play on the edge of his ability. And it's a different kind of soulfulness, you know. I think Carl was playing off of Steve's lyrics, and, you know, which a guitar player should do. And he was providing the foil, which a lead guitar player should do. But, you know, Steve's guitar playing is pretty damn amazing. So it was kind of a challenge to get the intertwining of Steve and Carl in the context of those songs. And so I think Sandy realized it. And I think, Carl got some very beautiful imperfections, I mean, you know, on these tracks, you know, while cutting the Sandy. If that makes sense at all.
It sounds like Sandy was the perfect producer for this album.
Yeah, in his own imperfect way. I think what it was, you know, Sandy didn't really have a vision of what this album was going to be. And I think that he instilled that in us is that it was an extensive gamble. And I think that it came out beautifully. And the best analogy that I've ever heard of the album, and I can't even remember who said it, and I wish I could credit the writer. It was like when you see a foreign film that you absolutely love, but you don't understand it, you know?
Wow.
And I think you know, it's a standalone piece, and it's a great American album. And I didn't listen to it for a very long time,
after we recorded it. I heard it at the playback at the A&M studios in Los Angeles, and then I didn't listen to it because I don't really go back and listen to stuff I play on very often. And I ran into Steve when I was living in Portland, and he sent me a copy of the reissue of the CD, and I was just shaken by it. It's a very dark masterpiece. I was literally trembling listening to it, you know, and I was like, Jesus Christ, this is amazing stuff, you know.
I'm glad you recognize it as a masterpiece, because we do as well.
Absolutely.
I did want to ask you, Dave, I don't know if you were there for the sessions, but Sid Griffin and Stephen McCarthy of the Long Riders, and also Gavin Blair from True West, were recording as part of this album. Were you there for their sessions?
No. They came by at a different time. And no, that would have been fun, but I wasn't there.
Okay.
But, you know, there was a lot of time to do things like that, that we weren't always there at the same time. And I think that Sandy, you know, had plenty of time to play around with things like that. They did some great work on that. That's really nice, but I wasn't there for that.
You know, I wanted to follow up on something you mentioned a little earlier. That you said, you know, there was a good vibe, a good energy coming from Geffen, and then the album's released by A&M. And so I just wanted to ask a little more about that. Was there, with A&M now behind this record, releasing it, did that change any of the energy around, you know, the recording process, or did you feel any pressure now recording for this label versus Geffen?
No, actually, that would be a hypothetical, because we didn't really have the experience of recording with Geffen to compare.
Right.
But can I tell you one little story of our...
Please.
We were on tour, and we pulled into Ann Arbor, Michigan, and it was kind of halfway through a long series of shows, and we find out that we're playing at Joe's Star Lounge in Ann Arbor, and we were on a bill with Destroy All Monsters, who are like one of my favorite bands, and you know that's connected to, you know, to the Ashtons and the Stooges, and Niagara, their lead singer, is just great. And so we're just like, you know, hanging out with Destroy All Monsters, and they're just the sweetest, nicest people. The whole show is great. But there was this guy, this kind of conservative older gentleman that was hanging out with us. There was a leaky pipe in the dressing room that was kind of spewing a fine mist on all of us. We were kind of getting soaked out there, but there wasn't any place else to go. And this older gentleman was back there speaking to Dennis mostly, and he was talking to us about jazz, and I think he realized that we were all kind of jazz fans. And he was very nice, and he hung out with us, he watched our show, and then we didn't see him again. It turned out that was Bill Friesen, the president of A&M Records.
Wow.
And he had specifically, you know, flown into to Michigan, to, you know, and been driven to Ann Arbor to see us in our natural habitat. And it was one of those magical deals that he liked us. And I think that he kind of really understood what we were doing, you know, and he's that kind of person that understood jazz and freeform music. An actual painting that he owned, that he had bought in Tibet, I believe it was Tibet or Nepal, became the cover of Medicine Show.
Oh, wow.
So,
wow.
He built his own personal painting, and so he felt a connection with us. The A&M thing worked out. I think that in reality, like any other rock band, they could have recorded a live version of what we were doing
before. I think that we could have just done a digital recording, DAT, at that point of any live show, and we would have had a Medicine Show album.
Uh-huh.
It probably would have been a more organic follow up to Days of Wine and Roses, because it would have just been kind of a stripped down rock band. But that wasn't to happen, you know. So what it became was this, you know, Medicine Show. So it was just a long series of happenstances. But there was some drama going on, you know, as far as it's not good for me to talk about things that were going on with Carl and Steve. But I think that they both felt that they had a leadership role. And after Dennis, was the real decision maker on a lot of things involved in the band, and a lot of wise decisions. I think he was often the voice of reason. So, but within that drama, I think you got a lot of beauty as far as creative tension. And I think that the tension between Steve and Carl was always a really beautiful thing. But I think I can't speak for Carl. So it's I love Carl, and so I can't really speak for him.
Can I share one little story of something that was just like unbelievable at the Automatic where we recorded?
Please.
Okay. The Automatic had four main studios, from what I remember. One smaller one that David Kahn was working with, Wiretrain, which was a much smaller studio. We were sandwiched in between studios where Jefferson Starship was recording, and in the other studio, Yoko Ono was recording. And we were kind of in between those two, those two acts. I had kind of come out of the tail end of the first psychedelic period. I was playing in bands in 68 and 69, and kind of Jefferson Airplane was one of my, I just worshiped them. And I had the longest crush, high school crush, on Grace Slick. And I always figured that, I always wanted to meet her. One night I was doing some bass repairs really late at night with Sandy, and overdub punches, and they had a very nice coffee lounge in the studio. And so I went in to get coffee, and I find myself alone with Grace Slick. And Grace is just the nicest, just sweetest person. I was so happy to be talking to her. She was just chatty and asking how our sessions are going, and do you enjoy it here? And she was very nice and very funny and just warm. And while I was talking to her, the door opens and Yoko Ono walks in. And she goes in to get some tea, and Grace turns to her and goes, "Hello." And Yoko just grabs her tea and runs out of the room as fast as she could. Grace turns to me, and she looks at me, and she goes, "What a cunt." And I think I had a witty reply like, "Yeah."
Wow.
But it was kind of like, two of the biggest figures of the peace and love movement of the 1960s, and here I am. Did I just see that?
Wow. That is incredible.
It was very funny. But all in all, it was a really great experience. At the time, I don't think it was always a great experience. I had been in situations where things had to be recorded over and over again. I had experienced that with Dwight Twilley shortly before I was playing with Dream Syndicate, where we had actually done one song over about 40 times just to get the rhythm tracks perfect. But when you multiply that over the course of months, 7 days a week, it's a very you lose track of where you are. You know, didn't we just record that? Yeah, and you're going to record it 300 more times before the day is over. And, you know, it wasn't painful because I think that's what musicians do. In the 1950s, you know, you always heard of Elvis doing Hound Dog, you know, a zillion times before they got the 64th track or whichever track they went with. And so that was, you know, that was part of the whole rock and roll ethic. But it was not exactly recording on a budget, you know. But the one thing where I was leading with this was every time we'd walk in the studio, we'd grab our instruments and we'd record a different version of John Coltrane, or at least it seemed like that. And there were so many spectacular versions of that that I wish we had every one of those chronicled, because they were all different. Every time we did it, it was different, and it was pretty spectacular.
Wow.
Now I want those tracks too. Yes, I want to hear that too.
We would love to hear those. So Dave, I wanted to ask you, do you have a favorite song from Medicine Show?
Yes, Burn. I just love Burn. I think it's just a fantastic song. But everything is really good on it. I mean, I like what they do now. We saw them, what was it, a little over a year ago. When Kendra came back and played with the band here at the El Rey in Los Angeles, the band right now is just as good as they've been. It's just, you know, with Chris Cathaway in the band. I don't know Jason. I've never met him, but he's spectacular as a guitar player. And the band is just probably at the top of their game now. But what they do is they actually play song Medicine Show.
I've got a one-way ticket, the 806 to the outskirts of town. I'm going down to the Medicine Show. I'll say, it's hard to be a reasonable man when you stop finding reasons for everything. Yeah. But tonight I'll get some answers, babe, on the Medicine Show. The Medicine.
With the actual feel of Daddy's Girl.
My baby wants to go to the place where she first made love. Well, take you on down to the liquor store. Wipe out everything that came before. What else can I do for Daddy's Girl?
So it's kind of a two-step, and it swings, and it is just you know, they're able to Steve can change things around to fit his moods, and he's always been able to do that. So I think it's just amazing what they're doing now. I don't know if you've heard anything off of Black Light, the new recordings, but it's really, really incredible.
Agreed. Yeah. We've just heard the lead off single, which we
love.
So, Dave, it sounds like you had a great time recording this album. What led to you no longer being in the band after Medicine Show?
I think I wasn't tall enough. I think a height requirement. Well, you know, Steve and Carl actually broke up the group. I think there were a lot of just weird. It was a pretty emotional thing for everyone involved. There were, you know, as far as the recording of Medicine Show, we had some time off before the release, and then we all got back together. The label, got us back together. And we were at rehearsals at a place called The Alley in Los Angeles, a very legendary rehearsal studio. And at this point, Tom Zavonchuk was on board. he was just kind of a professional musician that could, a chameleon that can play with anybody. And he, as keyboardists were doing at that time, they were doubling what the bass players were playing. And I would often, with the Dream Syndicate, change my lines as the songs would, you know, would evolve, or different nights would require, you know, changes, especially in like long jam sections of songs where the bass isn't going to always be exactly the same. And he was doubling my bass lines out of lack of, I think he thought it would sound bigger. It was a trend at that time. And I could have like set my bass down. I could have gone to the bar and gotten a drink and come back, and I wouldn't have missed anything because he was doubling all my parts. And that was particularly irritating, but it wasn't something that I could really negotiate. And the other thing is I'm not really a singer. And as I was playing these songs, I was realizing that they would probably, you know, and as it turned out, it really didn't require a whole lot of backup vocals anyway at any point. But I think there was a little, you know, I was playing with other bands. I've always been kind of a band whore as far as juggling, numerous bands. And at that time, I think Steve wanted me just to focus on, on Dream Syndicate. And so it was my decision to leave. And of course, you know, I kind of questioned it for the last, 30 something years. But the one thing that really did work out was Mark Walton. And I knew Mark we have the same hometown. I always rehearsed at his rehearsal studio. I always liked Mark. And I think he was the perfect person. And obviously he clicked with Steve and the band because he stuck with it all these years. So I think that was one of those things that was kind of meant to happen, you know, and I think, that worked out for the best. And so, I love the band. After the band, I continued playing with Carl, and, Carl, you know, was playing live shows with the Droogs, a band that I've played with, you know, off and on over the years for many years. And then we cut two albums with Paul Cutler producing. We were recording songs written by Steve, and Steve actually sang on one of the records of the Droogs. I continued seeing Steve when I was playing with Holly and the Italians, with Holly Vincent. We were playing very often with Steve Wynn quintet. And the Continental Drifters, we had a regular Tuesday night at Raji's thing for the longest time. So it's kind of like I've never, you know, and then I've played in the in Russ Holman's band, you know, for many years, and that is connected to Steve. Russ was, you know, and Russ was with Kurt Swan from Dump Truck, and recently been playing with Dream Syndicate. He filled in for Jason when Jason's wife had a baby. And we have Kevin Jarvis was Steve's drummer in the quintet, and he's playing with Russ now. And Robert Lloyd has been a long time Steve Wynn member. So there's still this weird, you know, connection. So it was, everything worked out for the best.
Dave, I wanted to ask another question. You know, you mentioned that you played ASIC shows with the band, and, you know, some venues big, some small, and some, you mentioned that some of those smaller venues stuck out in your mind just because there was something very special about it. Can you talk to us a little about some of the live shows that, you know, any stories you'd like to share about live shows that supported this album?
Well, the live shows that were supporting that album ahead of time, and we were doing songs, Armed with an Empty Gun, Burn, were actually you know, kind of organically meshing with the songs from Days of Wine and Roses and various cover tunes that we were doing. I mean, you know, we would do just, yeah, so those were interspersed within the set. So Bullet With My Name On It was originally a much faster song live. Mm-hmm. I don't know why we slowed it down in the studio. I guess it just felt like something that needed to be slowed down, I guess, to connect with the lyrics. You know, it worked better as a kind of, you know, morose song. But that was a rocker for the longest time. There were some, you know, I mean, there were some pretty amazingly fun, you know, and then, of course, John, you know, John Coltrane's Stereo Blues was in every, you know, every show. So specifically the ones that we were doing around San Francisco before record or while we were recording, there were some crazy shows. The Keystone in Berkeley, I remember one of the last times I'd seen Carl smash a guitar. You know, he was going through guitars left and right. It was, but not in a, you know, Pete Townsend kind of way. He had his own unique style of smashing guitars. My wife and I actually met at the Dream Syndicate show in Richmond, Virginia.
Wow.
So that was a fun show. And so I think that there, you know, of course, you know, anytime we played in New York, it was always, we were very popular there. And I think just because of the advent of college radio, I think that we were extremely popular. And it was, it was really, really, really something that was exciting to be a part of. That's for sure.
Well, Dave, we wanted to thank you for coming on to the show. And you had so many great stories about Medicine Show.
Oh, my God.
I never would have expected all these great stories. But we really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us about this album that we love and all your great stories.
Yes.
Well, thanks. I know it was kind of a sprawling, rambling mess, but I really don't do a lot of interviews nowadays. I'm too busy playing. Now I've got to get dressed and get my equipment to a show.
So. Don't let us stand in the way. But Dave, we just want to thank you. Our listeners want to thank you for taking the time to talk about Medicine Show. Like Jeff said, we love this album, and we just love to dig into the history of the album and hear from the people who played it. So thank you so much for taking time today. We look forward to hearing Russ's new album and your participation on it. And get ready for that other musical landscape. We're excited. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you, Dave.
Have a great day.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, Soraya, what did you think about that interview with Dave Provost and that story about them being in San Francisco? Grace Slick and Yoko Ono? What? What?
Man, Grace Slick just jumped up a couple of pegs in my book. That is nuts.
I had never heard that story before. That was so crazy.
That's kind of crazy, but man, anything happens, I guess, in a recording studio in San Francisco.
Right? Can you imagine you're recording an album? It's your first major label. On one side of you is Jefferson Airplane. I mean, Jefferson freaking Airplane, right?
Yep.
And on the other side, Yoko Ono. I'm like, gosh.
Get out, man.
That was. I really enjoyed talking to both of those guys today. And it was I think it was really special that we had a chance to talk to the entire rhythm section for this album that I've been listening to for 35 years. And just hearing these stories and their takes and their remembrances about what went on to make this album happen.
Mm-hmm.
That was
Totally agree. And I have a new appreciation for John Coltrane Stereo Blues.
Yes, yes.
I have a totally new appreciation for that song.
Yes.
Especially after listening to Dennis talk about its origins.
Right.
What do you call it? Open Hour.
Open Hour,
right. Open Hour. Yeah. And that transforms over time. You know? Thought that was so cool.
That was cool. And then when the 40th anniversary comes up and they do the 5-disc set, we're going to have 2 discs of just versions of that song alone, right?
I love it.
Yes.
And you know what? I wouldn't put it past them. At all.
Yes. I guess one last thing, the new album, Blacklight, is a crazy song. And like Dennis mentioned at the top of the episode, they're taking it in a new direction. And I'm really curious to hear all the different styles that they've laid out as if it's a DJ set, right? So that's how he said that Steve described it. I can't wait to hear this.
Isn't that a neat way to think about it, though? You know, that it's like a late night DJ.
Yes, yes.
A late night DJ experience. That's it.
I like it.
Oh man,
can't just wait for it.
Cool. You know, they never stop surprising us.
Mm-mm. All right.
And P.S. I'm holding Dennis stuck to his offer to talk to us about the new album.
Yes.
No pressure.
That's hilarious. All right. Well, we should probably call it an episode.
Let's do it. Gente, agrubiar. Go listen to Medicine Show. Delight your ears.
Please. And groove on, Paisley people.
Later.
Well, thank you so much for accepting our call, Dennis. We had a few questions that we wanted to ask you.
He's out.
Oh, why?
Said he left, so you may want to ring him again.
We'll do that. I'm still keeping that kids on there. You know it.
I like that.
Here we go.
There he
got
is.
Disconnected. Hey, something happened. I don't know what's going on.
It's all good. We're just really happy to hear your voice, and we're ready to jump into this. We know that you've got a schedule to keep, so do you mind if we just hop into this?
Get in there. Get in there. You never know what'll happen.
And I even like that response better. Today we're speaking with...
So can you speak a little bit? I want to make sure that we hear you clear.
Yeah.
Okay.
Unaccustomed to public speaking as I am, I would like to say a few words on behalf of myself and the other members of the orchestra.
Oh, perfect. You sound great.
Could I share one? I hope you're going to edit this because it's turning into a sprawling.
We will.